I'm not going to talk much about Venezuela. When I was originally asked to talk, the product a little bit of some discussions around the office on what Venezuela teaches us about some questions that I think the socialists have taken for granted. How Venezuela challenges certain precepts that we may have had from the history of the socialist movement through to today. And principally that relates, I think, to the questions of transition, that is the question of how you move from a capitalist society to a socialist society and what stages that goes through. So questions of that revolutionary transition. And related questions, I think, on the weight of different aspects of the tasks that exist, especially in third world countries, democratic tasks, national tasks, questions of the indigenous population which have come to the fore, questions of national independence, and then also there's questions more specifically socialist tasks in relating to workers' control and nationalisation and so on. And I'm not an expert. I don't claim to be an expert on these things, just some things I've thought about and I want to share some of those thoughts, really, some reflections. I've been involved in the socialist movement, I've been involved in solidarity struggles of various revolutions, beginning with Vietnam, through to the period of the Nicaraguan Revolution, the Grenada Revolution in Grenada, solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. And I think there are some obvious differences about what we're seeing today that will help us, I think, in terms of developing a revolutionary strategy, a successful revolutionary strategy for that transition in the future. What I think we were used to, all revolutions, nearly all revolutions that we have witnessed or experienced from back to the Paris Commune, if you like, that had a socialist character, all of them were in large part the product of war and social collapse. The Paris Commune came to power with the defeat of France by Bismarck. The Russian Revolution came about after years of war, millions dead. The Chinese Revolution, after an imperialist invasion, years of war resisting that invasion, the civil war that followed. Korea and Vietnam, growing out of the national independence struggles and the attempts to reimpose imperialist controls on those societies. Revolutionary wars for national independence. So the rupture with capitalism, if you like, or the rupture with the capitalist regime that existed, coincided with a military confrontation, and the collapse of the previous regime and its army, and its replacement with a new revolutionary regime and army. That pattern was followed with some modification outside of the context of world wars, but via guerrilla wars in Cuba and Nicaragua. But again, a period of war, an alternative army, an alternative apparatus, a revolutionary rupture of that had an associated military form other side to that was that in nearly all of these revolutionary processes, the suppression of the bourgeois economy, the capitalist economy, proceeded at an extremely rapid pace. Whether by desire or plan or not, because I think in some cases not, but the period where virtually every capitalist was nationalised, where all aspects of the market economy were largely suppressed, and the bourgeoisie was eliminated as a class, all proceeded very quickly. And there existed what could be dubbed planned economies of a socialist character, in which the state was the player, in which the state apparatus was the planner, and ultimately. People can decide at what stage of the process this has occurred in these countries, but excluded the mass of the population from the decision-making processes ultimately. And the state and the bureaucratic machine became the predominant force and player. And popular participation was minimised, and any form of sort of market processes were largely suppressed. I think that some of this has been. This process has been internalized to be by the socialist movement that this is what should always happen. Either there is no revolution unless there's a military rupture of some sort, or if you come to power, or if socialists or radicals or revolutionaries come to power through some process, that the only route is immediate widespread nationalisation and suppression of all aspects of a market economy, and insofar as it fails to do that, the revolution fails as test or some sort of test as to what it should do. And I think that is fundamentally wrong. And I think we can see it. If we're looking back from the process in Venezuela. At the beginning of what happened in Venezuela, you had what seemed like a radical in the mould and possibly of the previous or leftist military people in Latin America, nationalists, but, you know, nothing too much could be expected from this Chavez, quite possibly a demagogue, quite possibly just a bourgeois nationalist, and so on. But it's become clearer and clearer, I think, that what you have in Venezuela is, in fact, a revolutionist who, by an accident of history, got elected to the presidency of a bourgeois republic, but who remained a revolutionist and has systematically sought to advance the revolutionary process from day one. And doing that by using all of the tools at his disposal, including the governmental tools he had at his disposal of a bourgeois republic, but then in the process of escalating confrontations with the bourgeoisie and escalating mobilizations of the working class, gaining more and more independence and control of the process through the team that, with the team that he is building, more and more control. The bourgeois state doesn't disappear overnight, but is challenged on a continuum, and it's not suppressed in a bureaucratic way, but is challenged and bypassed, and they have certain, because they have access to oil wealth, it gives them a leeway that would not exist quite possibly in other situations, but they are able to build alternative revolutionary institutions alongside of the existing bourgeois state, which was unresponsive to the demands. So he's building new state institutions, he's weakening the political and economic hold of the bourgeoisie, and rather than trying to use a bureaucratic or process to suppress that class, either politically or economically, the transformation goes hand in hand with mobilisation. That is, you don't, you can't destroy the bourgeoisie as a class until the working class is capable of taking the reins of power. Unless you want to create a new tyranny, a new nightmare for the working class. But until the working class and popular classes more generally are able and have learnt to take power in a very real sense, on the ground, in their communities, in the agricultural, in the rural areas, in their factories, and this process takes time. And the process, and it takes time, and the organisation of those classes is done not just around questions of nationalisation, but around questions of land reform, of literacy, of access to healthcare, of education, and all of those mobilisations, and forming cooperative, all those mobilisations are necessary part of that transformation process. How far has it got to go? I don't know. I think what is clear is that Chavez is also knows the next stage, that there are further stages of the process, that putting socialism directly on the agenda for the presidential elections, calling for the formation of an explicitly socialist political party, which now has 5.5 million registered people to be become members of that party in Venezuela, that he knows that there is a need to organise and articulate this process more consciously going forward. But I think where we should start is that we should have confidence that, in fact, from the experience so far, he has been a very smart revolutionary political leader on a continental scale and on a world scale. He is leading a confrontation. It will involve a confrontation with the bourgeoisie and its expropriation, but not in an artificial and bureaucratic or premature manner, but in part depends on questions of revolutionary intervention and how much the bourgeoisie decides to respond through economic sabotage and so on. But he's been very smart in moving that. I think he's been very smart in moving that process forward in tandem with the organisation and ability and consciousness of the people of Venezuela. And I think that seems to be, and again, I'm not the expert, but that seems to be true in Bolivia as well, in a much more difficult, circumstance, with many more players and indigenous and the miners and the independent miners and the shantytown dwellers and so on and so forth. But in my view, it seems to me that Evo Morales is moving that process forward consciously and intelligently, and the new guy in Ecuador seems very impressive as well. But again, time will tell. That I don't know. But in terms of what he's saying and saying he wants to do in Ecuador and how they're going to do it, it seems. But this, so we're coming to where the possibility of revolutionaries, if you like, the possibility of revolutionaries winning elections, not power, but winning elections under bourgeois democratic regimes, and then what steps can be taken to advance the revolutionary process. Is that possible? It appears to be possible. It appears to be happening in Latin America. Shouldn't be dismissed. We should try and learn from it. We should try and learn from that process, and we certainly shouldn't write it off. So welcome. One of the things about Latin America, because it is Latin America that I think is the continent of the future, and there's a reason for that, and that's Cuba. You see, none of this would be possible without Cuba. None of it would be possible without Cuba. Cuba's survival allowed for these revolutions to come about. Cuba's survival allowed for Grenada and Nicaragua to happen. Cuba's survival allowed the revolutionary government of Venezuela to survive. It is allowing and giving room for, together they are allowing and giving room for, the government of Bolivia to survive, advance in increasingly radical actions. At a pace, I think, at a pace and a stage that the population can understand, be part of, be organised and consciously led, that the working population as a whole has got to be involved. That's what I said, that can't be done administratively. So these are revolutionary leaders who are deeply, have a deep relationship with the masses in their country and trying to advance that process. But the survival of Cuba and the revolutionary solidarity of Cuba has been absolutely vital for the survival of these processes in Latin America. And that's where anybody who thinks that Cuba is not a revolutionary government needs their minds read. Because this government has done everything to subordinate its interests to the interests of the revolutionary struggle internationally. They have sent 20,000 doctors to Venezuela. They would send 20,000 soldiers, like they sent 250,000 soldiers over 15 years to Angola to defeat the South Africans, and asked for nothing in return, didn't take the oil from Angola or the diamonds. The only thing they took from Angola were the bodies of their soldiers. Cuba has acted in an unselfish, revolutionary, internationalist manner from day one of the Cuban Revolution, and they do it today, and that's why we know that Cuban Revolution is still surviving, that Cuban Revolution is still alive. They have bureaucratic problems. They made mistakes. It was wrong for them, in my view, to nationalise everything down to the shoeshine boys in 1968. That was just dumb, and you see it's dumb when you go to Cuba today and you can't get a shoe repaired. But they remained revolutionary in their views and outlooks, that the bureaucratic degeneration that did occur has been, I think, fought, combated, controlled, not allowed to conquer the government, not allowed to defeat the revolution, that the bureaucratism is under control, hasn't been allowed to defeat the revolution. It exists. It's a constant battle. But the Cuban Revolution is vital to the future of Latin America. They reach out to every fighter who emerges. The day Chavez, he went to jail when he did his coup, tried to do his coup in 92, was it? Did his coup, went to jail. Virtually the day he was released from jail, Cuba invites him to give a lecture on Bolivarian revolutionary thought. At the university and at some sort of institute in Havana, and he goes there, and they have there is a deep and intimate personal relationship that exists. And it's a revolutionary relationship between leaders of a revolutionary process. They are and it's a very intimate and day-to-day relationship between the leaders of the Cuban Revolution, the leaders in Venezuela, and the leaders in Bolivia. And it's one of the strengths of the revolution, not one of its weaknesses.